I declare the meeting open, and we will give over to Neglect, like all other entities that came before you. We appreciate the fact that you are here, and we have an opportunity to know more of what you are doing as such entities, and engage the engagement for us to know more and understand what we could not understand in that thing. And that is the future here when we dealt with that entity. We will ask questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair, honourable members and colleagues, acting DG and DDG. It's indeed a pleasure, Madam, to be given this opportunity, I think, just to provide you with some background of the entity, and as I understand the brief, to sort of take you through some of the, if you want, strategic challenges, how we're trying to deal with those. We'll look at the performance of the entity, and I think perhaps share some ideas around some of the big challenges going forward. We certainly, however, due to time constraint, I think we have tried to prepare a presentation just to meet the deadline for Monday. We have, however, circulated an additional presentation just to enrich. So I'm going to, at the outset, beg your indulgence if there are some slides in the overhead that may not be in your pack. But I have just tried to sort of, as I understood the brief this morning, try to add in a few additional slides. And then just to say, Madam, I think we certainly welcome the opportunity to, and this is a beginning for future interaction and engagement with the committee members, I think, on an ongoing basis. Let me also perhaps just to dispense of all of the apologies, to apologize on behalf of the overall conveners from NEDLAC. We had a management committee meeting on Monday, and I did indicate that we would be coming down to portfolio committee. Most of the overall conveners, given the short notice, were not available to attend, but we do have the overall convener from government. Mr. Felipe was now wearing, I think, three hats, so he is asked to put on his NEDLAC hat while he is here as well. And then also just apologies from our operations head, Mr. Naidu. We had taken leave, he had applied for leave a while ago already, so he could not be here today. If I then, so we do have a small team, it's really just from the secretariat, it's myself, and then my colleague Cornel Martens, who's the Chief Financial Officer, and then just Mr. Buntu Ndonda, who's the senior coordinator that spans our management committee projects. It is essentially the special projects, and she works very closely with the head of operations, and I've asked to join us. And then perhaps finally, Madam, I think just to clear this up, I'm not trying to make a political statement with the shirt, it's more of a fashion statement. I have some questions, I forgot the blue tie. And my name is Alistair Smith, I'm the acting director for NEDLAC, and I've been in this position now just over 2 years. Okay, just by way of background, I think we just want to share perhaps some of the origins of NEDLAC and some of the purposes of NEDLAC, and I think it's important to make the point that the NEDLAC Act was one of the first acts of Parliament that was passed. And in my view, that's extremely significant in the message and the symbolism that it sent. And I think when we do get into a debate in the last couple of months, in fact, over the last year and a bit, there's been quite a lot of discussion around NEDLAC and the role of NEDLAC and the social dialogue and the challenge and the relevance of the institution. And while I think some of the criticisms, perhaps, we should reflect on them, I think some of the discussions, perhaps, do not appreciate the original intention and significance of this particular entity and of the founding act of this entity, which was, I think was really the first signal of our willingness and our commitment to move away from the apartheid legacy at an institutional level. And I think that's very important that we don't take discussions around the future of the entity lightly. Secondly, I think Madam Chair, just to point out that there are three basic, if you want, documents that guide the work of NEDLAC, or I should say should guide the work of NEDLAC, because it's a contested space. The first is the NEDLAC Act, and that outlines obviously the legal mandate and the basic requirements. It was one of the, as I said, one of the first acts. So it perhaps has some, it's a very simple act, one of the simplest pieces of legislation I think that you will find, and essentially is an enabling piece of legislation, so not overly prescriptive, but captures the underlying intention of NEDLAC as the social, the apex body for social dialogue in South Africa. Then you've got the NEDLAC Constitution, which has been around for a very long time. I think, and I want to talk a little bit about governance, and I think it's something that would have to be looked at, but this is the bedrock of the interaction between parties, and certainly the governance of the entity. This constitution was set up before the TFMA, and I think that that's a significant point to note later on when we talk about some of the challenges that we get to. And then there's the NEDLAC protocol documents. This is basically the documents that guides the, if you want, the rules of engagement between the social conference. It sets the, if you want, the basic time frames and the basic disciplines for engagement. So those are the three documents I think that we would need to look at in an integrated way. Quickly to talk about the objectives of NEDLAC, and there's no particular logical sequence, but I think just to start with the first one that's in the act, and that's to strive, and I think it's important to look at the language, because some of the language is quite, if you want, obligatory, some of the language is aspirational. And so the first aspirational objective of NEDLAC is to strive to promote the goals of economic growth, participation in economic decision-making and social equity. And this is embedded in the NEDLAC Act. And if you want, it gives meaning to the consensus within our constitution. Secondly, and again an aspirational thing, it's not prescriptive, is to seek to reach consensus and to conclude agreements on matters pertaining to social and economic policy. Again, I think in the aspirational sense, it recognizes the challenges around finding consensus, but certainly there is an obligation on all social partners to, if they're part of the rules of the game, if you participate, then you are compelled to be committed to trying to find consensus. And sometimes consensus will elude us, but you have to subscribe to the principle of wanting at least to find consensus. Then it becomes a bit more obligatory. It says that NEDLAC shall consider all proposed legislation. It's not an equal maybe. All proposed labor legislation in this country has to be considered by NEDLAC. Now, what considered means, I suppose, is a different issue, and that's been open to discussion. But certainly it has to be considered. Similarly, all significant changes to social and economic policy has to be considered by NEDLAC, and the key thing is before it is introduced to Parliament. If I can just pause a bit, Madam, I mean, I think these two objectives capture, if you want, the core mandate of NEDLAC. I mean, to take all the other stuff away, this is, if you want, the kind of day-to-day business of the entity. And very, I mean, as part of our law-making process, and that's, I mean, we can argue and debate this, but that's fundamentally what we agreed to when we established the NEDLAC. And that was the commitment arising out of, if you want, the consensus that underlies post-apartheid South Africa. That we made this commitment that we would involve our social partners in an organized way, in a disciplined way, in the process of lawmaking. Secondly, finally, it is to encourage and promote the formulation of coordinated policy on social and economic matters. And I think this is an important one in the current context. And that's something that along our development over the last 20 years may have gone missed. But certainly to see one of the objectives of the institution as being to hand in hand with government somehow as a filter perhaps to facilitate the process of coordinating policy formulation at the very least, if not implementation thereof. So just to put that in another way, I'm just transposing the legal mandate, and I'm putting this in different forms. But yes, our overriding, if you want, aspiration is to see economic growth and equity and participation in decision making through social dialogue. There's a commitment to try and find consensus on social and economic policy. And then if you want, the foundational, the core business being to consider labor legislation and all other aspects of socio-economic legislation. But I'm here just to quickly give you an overview of the structure of the entity. Essentially, we have four chambers. And this is captured within the constitution and to some extent within the act as well. We have the development chamber, which deals with broad, and I think the original intention was that it would deal with broad developmental issues, particularly dealing with women and youth, the disabled, etc. Then there's a trade and industry chamber that deals primarily with trade policy and industrial policy and legislation associated therewith. Public finance and monetary policy, obviously, that deals with the more macroeconomic aspects of economic policy, particularly issues around fiscal policy and monetary policy, interest rates, exchange rates, etc. And then, of course, the labor market. These are, the kind of engine rooms of the network engagement. So all legislation, all policy proposals, whether it's in the form of a green paper, comes to these chambers and is considered and in many ways negotiated through these particular chambers. Then we have the management committee, which has specific functions that set up within the constitution, and it's in a sense a bit of a two-part structure. It's a structure that's responsible for governance of the entity in the same way that the governing body would be. But it's also a forum for social dialogue, and it's a forum that in terms of the constitution at least, should be used to try and facilitate consensus and unblocking things. Then you've got the executive council. Now this is actually the accounting authority. This is actually the board in the true sense of the word, in which you would understand if we look at King's recommendations and all of that. That's a structure that's quite a big structure. It's composed of 18 representatives from each of the constituencies, government, labor, business, and the community. So it's a very big structure, and I think part of the problem with this structure is that it is quite a big structure. It's also the structure that originally was intended to be provide the kind of strategic leadership, if you want, around most of the policy issues. From governance side, it includes, and this is again from the constitution, it includes the Minister of Finance, the Minister of Trade and Industry, the Minister of Public Works, and there's some reasons for that historically, which we can talk about, and the Minister of Labour, of course. And then we have the National Summit, again in terms of the Act and the Constitution, we must convene a National Summit. And really the intention behind this National Summit is that it acts as a broad consultative forum. So it's not just within, if you want, within the insiders, not just with the organized constituencies, but also to allow you to be able to take on board and consult with broader society, if you want. And that is the original intention. But these are the structures that are prescribed. In terms of the constituencies, basically, as I said, four basic constituencies. Business as an apex organization is represented through BUSA, Business Unity South Africa. For labor, we've got three federations, and again, this is historic, COSATU, NAPTU, and BUSA. And then from government side, if you want the key departments driving these things, and from time to time, other departments will be involved, depending on what the issues are. But if you want the core departments, is the Department of Labor, Trade and Industry, Public Works, National Treasury. From an accounting perspective, of course, we are part of the budget vote of the Department of Labor. And so we account to the Minister of Labor as the executive authority. Just a rough overview around the process, madam. I mean, we generally, if you want, you could sort of break the typical NEDLAC process down into three phases, if you want. The first is a scoping phase. In other words, there would be a piece of legislation that government would have indicated we are going to bring to the chamber for negotiation. The chamber then agrees to set up a casting. The casting will develop in terms of reference, and they will set time frames and that. So it's a scoping exercise. Then there's the engagement exercise. You've got the representatives within that particular task team. They've got the terms of reference, and they need to be adequately mandated to start engaging on the process. And this is very idealized, but then the task team engages, and typically what happens is the task team will take a piece of legislation, and they will work through the legislation in typical fashion, line by line, and look at the broad intention of the legislation, and we will develop a matrix, what they call a NEDLAC report, which looks at the responses from the various constituencies, and those will then be captured. As far as possible, clearly you want to get convergence on these issues. Then you finalize the report, hopefully you have as much convergence as possible that's captured in the report. The protocol then says that because government is part of those engagements, that the areas of agreement are the areas where government will go back and redraft the legislation to capture the consensus and to reflect the consensus. Where there is consensus and agreement, so firstly government will amend the legislation prior to bringing to parliament to reflect the consensus. But secondly, the social partners are committed not to reopen those areas. So they can't come and lobby the portfolio committee to reopen those areas if they've already agreed to it. And that's the if you want, the rules of engagement in terms of the protocol. Clearly then a report is finalized. The essence of the agreement is captured in the matrix. The report is sent to the Minister of Labour, to the relevant minister, and is then submitted to Parliament. And ideally would be then be presented to the relevant portfolio committee, and there needs to be an interaction with the relevant portfolio committee. And Madam, maybe just to flag that, I think when we look at some of the challenges going forward, this is one area perhaps that we can maybe look at a bit more with the committee going forward. It's not as one through that particular link. But also to use it, I think, to the best advantage for both from the perspective of Parliament and the lawmaking process, but also in terms of bringing the views of the social partners to the committee. So, Madam, just very briefly then, our vision is guided by the NEDLAC Act and the Constitution, really is that we use social dialogue to promote growth, equity, and participation. The mission is essentially to give effect to the NEDLAC Act and as far as possible to promote and facilitate consensus on labour legislation and socio-economic policy legislation. I want to then just turn moving off some of the background and just look at some of the, if you want, the strategic plan. And here I want to maybe just firstly share with you some of the strategic logic, and then look at some of the strategic goals that we have set. I am now in this position just over 2 years, and it's been a very interesting journey. When I started, I had a discussion with the minister just in terms of understanding the need and the challenges, and I think there was general consensus that we needed to want reposition and strengthen the role of the entity. And I think it was in a way recognizing that perhaps over the years we may not have given sufficient attention to the capacity of NEDLAC, and that something needed to be done. The plan that is in the current existence, the strategic plan, which is expiring in 2015, is basically driven by the following logic. There are two key, if you want, factors that ultimately drive the success of social dialogue. The one clearly is the social partners. It's the commitment and the capacity of the social partners to engage in social dialogue. The other element is of course the capacity of the secretariat. And sometimes the secretariat is there as a sort of support function, and a lot of that is administrative. Sometimes it's more than a support function and is more of a strategic support. And we need to pay attention to both parts, both elements, if we are serious about social dialogue. going forward. So in terms of our strategic logic, the focus, if you want, in the first phase of our work was on the secretariat and saying how do we rebuild the organization into a more effective and efficient organization, and I will share with you some of the results of that process. But secondly, also, how do we begin to, if you want, address some of the challenges within the social partners, within the constituencies, which is more of a difficult and complex issue to deal with. But together, those two elements is what gives you, if you want, effective engagement, effective social dialogue, and creates a constructive culture of engagement that then leads to the broad objective of promoting economic growth and equity and decent work. So Madame, we've tried to capture those intentions into our strategic plan and again the broad strategic outcome oriented goals as a rough to set that the entity must be and social dialogue must contribute to the achievement of decent work and economic growth as outlined in the various plans for the country, particularly within the NDP and the NGP, and must contribute to not just growth, but also to the reduction of inequality and poverty. That's ultimately why we want to have social dialogue. The other is then, and how do we then, as a goal, how do we promote and embed a culture of effective social dialogue and engagement? And really, we'll know that when we see, for example, in our labor relations, that there's greater cooperation between the social partners, greater consensus, greater cooperation, and therefore better outcomes. Promote effective participation in socioeconomic policy and also for one labour market policy and legislation. And as I said, this is the core business, the day-to-day business of the organisation. And one of the big criticisms has been, and I think sometimes quite justified, sometimes not, that you know things get to Nedlac and they get stuck. So one of the big, I think, priorities over the last years has been how do we improve on turnaround funds, and clearly here the time frames within the Nedlac protocol become very important. I mean this governs, if you want, the rules of engagement. And then of course the final goal, which from the secretariat perspective was really a focus on in the first phase, was around improving the organizational effectiveness. And that encompassed a number of things. It's improved governance and leadership, and also improved performance. And as well as risk management, and I'm wanting to highlight risk management, because I think part of the problem that we have had is the overlap between governance and social dialogue, and the cut and trust of social dialogue. And so how do we begin to manage those risks in a more appropriate way? Okay, I just then want to maybe start with the secretariat, and again by way of background, just very briefly, Madame, we have currently have a headcount of 30. When I started 2 years ago, we had a staff of 19, we had an organogram that allowed us up to 24. And we one of the things we looked at was to increase the level of resourcing. We've also had to look at getting greater alignment. We effectively had built a new team over the last 2 years. We've had to pay a lot more attention to issues around financial risk and compliance, SEM, and have had to then bring in additional resources to deal with that. Also from a process and system perspective, there were a number of gaps, so we had to start addressing some of the capacity constraints within the operations, if you want, so around IT and those kinds of support functions that were quite sorely lacking. And so we currently have a headcount of 30. In my view, it's not sufficient, but we have certain constraints, and you said we must talk about the challenges, I think. This is one of the challenges that we have to confront at some point. Just in terms then, if you want, specifically then, Madame, we talked a little bit about the strategic background, the strategic logic, what are the imperatives? Let's look at some of the more specific issues in the plan of the last year. And I want to just, I'm going to put that into some context at the next slide. But essentially, as I've said from the Secretariat point of view and within our APP, the focus has really been on improving and strengthening the Secretariat. So looking at support services, there's a number of things and targets that we have committed ourselves to within the APP. I'm not going to go through all of them. If you want cooperation, these are the chambers, the management committee. There's the main, if you want, trust measure within the APP is around the protocol document. So it's saying about that we will have these turnaround times. And we have set a target that none of the pieces of legislation will take longer than 6 months going forward. And this is a relatively, I mean, it's an old discipline in terms of the protocol, but in terms of its enforcement, it's relatively new. It's like in the last year or so, and I think we are beginning to see significant improvements in that area. Then we also said this year, in terms of our promoting social dialogue, to perhaps build more capacity into areas of communication and information and processing of information, if you want, to fuel the social dialogue process, to support the social dialogue process. And that's an area that we put some resources in, but I think still there we have some serious capacity constraints. So now I think, let's look at some of the results year on year. As I said, if you look at the 2011-2012, which was the year that I came in, we had a very difficult year that year. There was a difficult audit. It was a qualified audit. There was also a forensic investigation that was commissioned during that time. Which spoke to a number of, if you want, systemic weaknesses, particularly within the financial governance that we had to deal with and sort out. But I think more importantly, from a performance perspective, and this is also, if you want, the first year that the Treasury framework on performance evaluation kicked in from an auditing perspective. It was a very poor finding in terms of achievement of results. In fact, what the audit found was that only 33% of the objectives as per the APP were met. Now, I think there were a number of reasons for that. And one of the main reasons has been that the tradition has been that you have a sort of wish list of legislation that you put in the APP without taking due care of whether those matters will actually be tabled. And then halfway down the year, you find that the legislative program has changed, or for some reason, the minister decides he's not going to submit the legislation. Then you're stuck with your APP. There's nothing really that you can do with it. So we've had to apply our mind seriously to that particular problem. But we've also had to work quite hard in putting in place basic financial disciplines, particularly from an auditing and risk perspective. We had to put in a new structure, a new auditor's charter. From an SEM perspective, we've also had to put in place additional resources. So it was quite intense and it was quite demanding in terms of resources, as well as from an internal audit perspective, which never really existed in the past. So suddenly there was these additional compliance costs, if you want, that we had to take on board. But if you look at the results for the 2012-13 year, you will already begin to see a significant improvement. That in the very next year, we had an unqualified audit. There were still a number of, I think, important findings and gaps that we needed to address. But if you look at from a performance perspective, that the picture started changing quite dramatically. So in the previous year, this is audited, and this is based on a 100% sample. That 76% of the objectives as per the APP were met. We are currently undergoing an audit, which should be completed by the end of July. We also have a weekly steering committee meeting. Our audit is conducted by the Audit General as of last year. Now, that has also meant additional cost because it was an entirely new team and a new discipline that had to be applied. But I think we're hard on track. And certainly from a performance perspective, our goal was that we want to achieve at least 80% of the targets in the APP for this year, and we are very confident that we are on track to attain that. Well, Chair, I've just tried to summarize for you some of, in terms of the overall performance in some of the areas. So from a legislative perspective, we had in the APP originally three broad pieces of legislation that we had to complete. All of those were completed, but we also had, importantly, eight additional pieces of legislation that were tabled that we couldn't upfront in the APP. There was uncertainty around that. Of the eight that were tabled, we concluded five. Now, remember last year was a particularly special year from a legislative program because it's the year before the election year. So close to the June deadline, suddenly we found a spurt of sort of draft legislation coming that had to be considered, which put an additional burden on resources. But of the eight, if you want, arriving pieces of legislation, 63% was completed. We had, in terms of policy, and this is sort of whether it's a policy draft, whether it's a briefing session on a particular piece of policy, but as for the APP, we had 17 down, we achieved 15 of those, an overall of 88%. In terms of Section 77 notices, now these are, in terms of the Labour Relations Act, Section 77 allows a trade union or a federation to apply to the Section 77 Committee to embark on protected protest action on a socio-economic issue. Now we have seen over the last couple of years there's an increase in the number of these applications. We had 10 of those applications arising in the course of the 2014 year, and 70% of those were concluded. So I'm not going to go into the detail, but we'll come back to that. Just what I'm saying, the earlier problem that I alluded to, where you have issues on your APP or engagement, and then government doesn't table them, we again had that situation during the previous year. And just to highlight some of the issues that we had in the APP that did not come, included the Housing and Consumer Protection Bill, the Compensation for Occupational Injuries Act, and the review of the Codes of Good Practice on Dismissal. Now going forward, and this is partly why the protocol document with the Leader of Government, Business and Parliament is so important, is that we have greater certainty and, if you want, sign off on the legislative program so that we can then have better planning for the year. But there's always going to be an element of uncertainty, if you want, around this. Then just around some of the specific pieces and some of the, if you want, the sort of focused work areas in each of the chambers for the preceding period. In the Development Chamber, the restitution of Land Rights Amendment Bill, the Chair of the Public Administration Bill, but that was actually under the auspices, I think it was the Labour Market Chamber. The Norms and Standards of School Infrastructure, there's also a strategic session around the Expanded Public Works Program. The Labour Market Chamber, the Unemployment Insurance Amendment Bill and the Planning Bill were two of the key pieces also towards the end of the legislative year, if you want, that were dealt with. Another important piece of work within the Labour Market Chamber, which I think is going to be important going forward, is the Decent Work Country Program, which is an ILO program, but it's really the social partners, and it's a technical cooperation program with the ILO, but it's run under the auspices of the Labour Market Chamber. Then the Trade and Industry Chamber, which is also a very, very busy chamber, the Expropriation Bill, the Legal Mythology Bill, and then we have an annual biannual strategic session with the Minister around trade and industry policy. Just in terms of the strategic focus guiding the work this year, strengthening and consolidating the secretariat. So from a human resources performance point of view, the introduction of a performance management system. which we have started. It's now embedding that particular system, ongoing improvements in the risk and financial management, and ongoing improvements in the systems and processes that support the rest of the work. Our focus now increasingly is around the stakeholder capacity and commitment and sorting out the overall governance of the entity, and also ensuring disciplined adherence to the protocol documents. Going forward in our current APP, some of the plans involve again around the processes and systems. From an IT audit perspective, there's a number of gaps in the IT system that needed to be dealt with. The upgrading of the ICT infrastructure is something that requires attention. And then the revamping of the network house, which is something that we had planned for earlier and we had to put this off. But in the planning process, it was also clear that given the age of the building, there were a number of compliance issues resolved related to that. And so this has now become a priority project, and one of the issues for this year is the upgrading of the facilities and general compliance of what we call NEDLAC House. It is a physical property that is owned by the entity, which is where most of the meetings takes place, and this is where the secretariat is based. And Chair, also for this year, so we talked about strengthening the secretariat, but shifting focus slightly now to focusing more on production of research, capacity building sessions with the social partners, and more than one informal type engagements through workshops and symposiums. So it's how do we beyond just the formal constitutional structures, how do we integrate platforms where the social partners can engage in a way that is less adversarial, in a way that there's more evidence-based interaction. And so we want to begin to accelerate that process. And that's in the APP for this year, and will become an important part of the next strategic planning cycle. Okay, Madam, I hope this is visible, and then maybe just to switch at this stage to a summary of expenditure. And I'm going to ask Renaud just to come in on some of this as well. But I just want to highlight, I mean, the entity, if we compare this entity with a whole range of other entities and even Chapter 9 institutions, and we look at some of the expectations that's raised within the media, every plan that we've had, every other second policy talks about the importance of social dialogue. But yet, if we actually seriously look at the amount of resources over the last 20 years that we have spent on social dialogue, I think it tells us a very, very interesting story about our commitment to institutionalized forms of social dialogue. The entity has a very, very small budget of currently 26 million, 27 million, around 50 million for this current financial year. And over the last 3 years, thanks to discussions with the department, I think there's been recognition that we needed to ramp up the level of resources over the last 3 years to assist with bringing in additional capacity. Now, if we think about some of the things that the characters for social dialogue, if you look in terms of the research and the kind of capacity issues that's required, it's nowhere near, I think, what, if we just compare what is required. So the big message I want to make here is that we are working with a very, very limited budget, and within that budget we're trying to, as our strategic focus shifts, we're trying to shift resources into areas that will have the biggest impact in terms of the main expectations and the challenges that we have. And to find areas where we can maybe get additional savings. But I think ultimately, if we are serious about social dialogue in South Africa as a society, then we are going to have to pay very, very serious attention to the level of resourcing that we are putting. So from a financial discipline management perspective, you will see that, I mean, it basically, we don't budget for a deficit. And, we generally manage the finances in a disciplined way. So, Chair, just to maybe go into that in a little bit more detail, you will see that the capital expenditure generally has been quite small. We need to put more resources going forward, as I've said, into some of the infrastructure around IT and others that will facilitate, particularly from a communications perspective. And then in terms of, I mean, we are meeting intensive, so it is a lot about meetings and travel and bringing these social partners together. And there we have tried to bring in as much savings as possible. And then on the administration side, again, that reflects both, if you want, the governance and compliance part of the work, but also if you want the EXCO and the National Summit, which falls under the administration part. And then in terms of budget, I mean, we basically within the targets that we have set. Now, Chair, I think I just want to put that in because we have put in a proposal to the Department of Labor, but clearly given the cost-cutting exercises, we are within the MTEF commitments, but we have tried to reflect on what would be required, I think, if we actually seriously want to begin to address some of the strategic challenges we have. And what this indicates is we practically have to increase the budget by around 70%, I think, at the least. And we will have to come back to this particular question. And so I think maybe just to shift towards looking at the future, and I think there's been lots of debate, particularly the last 2 weeks, around the role of NEDLAC and the role of the CCMA. And I think in many ways we are at a crossroads. 20 years into democracy is true. When we look back, NEDLAC has made significant impact on the policy landscape, on the legislative landscape, on the institutional design. In the last 2 years, I think we've seen significant improvement in some of the performance, but social dialogue is under pressure. I think a lot of the fault lines within our society that we've inherited are beginning to expose themselves. And so in many ways, social dialogue is coming under pressure at the very time when we probably as a society need it the most. So we have a serious difficulty around the adversarial nature of engagement, and it's not just within this entity. I think if you go to many other stakeholder-driven institutions, you will find that the level of engagement is highly polarized, highly adversarial. And I think it's a societal issue that we need to begin to address. I think there's a serious trust and consensus deficit that's bedeviling us at all levels of society. Somehow we need to get our heads around that. At the same time, the triple challenges around employment inequality and poverty, I think it's not debating. We've had a number of, I think, very good agreements coming out of them, like the most recent being the response framework to the global crisis in 2009. Which introduced the training layoff scheme and others. We previously had the Growth and Development Summit. We've had a series of accords in the last 3 years that have been negotiated, the Youth Accord, etc. But the impact, I think, overall of these accords, from a social dialogue perspective, we can make certain commitments as social partners, but I think we have a difficulty in terms of the follow-through and implementation of those particular commitments, the monitoring of those, and if you want the feedback in terms of the ongoing dialogue to deal with the gaps in implementation. At the same time, I mean, I think we talked earlier in the CGMA presentation around the instability in the labour market, increased fragmentation, and also I think increasingly the vulnerability from a social protection perspective, which is being felt not just by those in in vulnerable sectors, but even those in formal employment, which is beginning to become a serious challenge. So the labor market and what's happening in the labor market, I think, is quite crucial. But I think how we deal with that is also important. And in the last, I think, couple of months around Marikana and the Platinum Strike, I think there's a risk that we don't get into a sort of knee-jerk type response and not deal with the fundamental challenges that we face. And that I think is one of the big questions we need to confront going forward. So I just want to, in terms of sort of moving towards closure, I think for me what was quite significant was in the latest State of the Nation address and the call made by the President for the social partners to specifically get together to address the situation within the labour market. And the recognition that we also need to deal with the question of inequality and specifically wage inequality. And I think speaks to, if we really want to begin to address these questions, we need to have a much deeper understanding of what's going on. But that also means that we need to have high-level political commitment and leadership across all of the constituencies to confront these challenges. So, I think some of the difficulties that we have in the social dialogue process is clearly the contestation around the national vision. And I think and that's not just a social dialogue network concern. I think that is also a political issue, and it's not something that's unique to us. I think it's part of the cut and thrust of politics, if you want, in a global situation of increased competition and increased vulnerability, increased risk, and where there's increased conflict. And I think most democracies are struggling with this particular question. But certainly that we need to intensify the pursuit for some level of consensus is important. I think clearly the role of leadership across the constituencies is an important one. Then I think a broad challenge that keeps on coming up is around policy coherence and coordination, that a lot of the reforms, not just in the labour market but in other areas, tends to be ad hoc and piecemeal. We have a job to do in terms of considering that legislation, but in terms of the other part of the mandate, which is responding to the big questions in our economy, I think there's a challenge in that policy is not very clear, and I think we need to have a serious conversation around it at some point. Then there are the institutional constraints, both within our labour market institutions, some of them, not all of them. There's a debate around the relevance of some of our labour market institutions, but I think increasingly the capacity and also the commitment of social partners to dialogue. And if you want the increased fragmentation within the traditional constituencies, we talked earlier about this issue of new actors and increased rivalry. I think that is something that is there now, and we are going to have to find ways of dealing with that. And then I think one of the big institutional constraints, and I think that of implementation, if you want service delivery. And if you say, you know, we can come up with the relevant commitments as social partners, we can have the energy, we can have the positivity, but we've got to make sure that things are implemented and that we have delivery. And there may well be a role for an institution like NEDLAC within that. And we think that it is about monitoring and tracking and beginning to highlight some of the main gaps within not just policy but within the implementation. So going forward, Chair, I think we need to discuss this issue around, you know, how do we get to this national consensus? How do we get to this greater cooperation? Some people have said we need to have a big economic cadessa. I personally am not entirely persuaded about that, given my sense of the sort of realities on the ground. I don't think we're ready for that just yet. But I do think that we can't just sit back. I do think that, for example, initiatives like this presidential call for a leadership discussion under the auspices of NEDLAC is very important. I think it is about perhaps smaller attempts and sometimes more informal attempts to begin to get consensus. And it's very much about the leadership conversation. And it's about saying that we actually going to have to become a lot more bold and courageous as leaders, And a lot of the tough conversations are not conversations that we have across the table, but in fact conversations that we have to have within our own constituencies. And that, I think, is the big challenge really that faces us from a social dialogue perspective. So it is about bridging the trust gap and the challenge about can we actually work together in the interests of our nation. Thank you very much, Chair. We are ready to hear what any questions. Thank you.
Over to you, members. Ask questions. Clarification, thank you. Honorable Parkley, okay. Honorable America, Honorable Lollywood, Honorable Juan Calpe, Honorable Olive, Honorable Wally, and the last was your hand up, Honorable. Honorable Magician, in that order.
Madam Chair, if I may, Mr. Director, we saw that you spent almost 2 years in dialogue over some of the changes to the labor law. Once you've come to what appears to be agreements that came back to this committee, that was changed, those agreements were changed to a large degree. I want to know whether the social partners felt any displeasure or whether they felt that they were merely talking on a toy telephone. Was there any value in that 2 years worth of discussion? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. My question is basically a follow-up on the previous question, Madam Chair. The Director stated in his presentation that once the rules of engagement had been agreed upon within the Chamber, then parties cannot lobby subsequent processes to have what they have lost out in the negotiations process to have it put on the agenda again. And the question is, how binding is the consensus within the Chamber that would prevent parties from reopening or, you know, have their own advocacy and lobbying sort of process on the way? And if they do violate that consensus, what sanctions are in place if parties do violate the protocols? Because the reason why I ask that, it links up with the previous question that the labor legislation that was reached consensus on particularly certain sections and this directive, know what I'm referring to. And then after it has come here to Parliament, then whatever was agreed upon within the Chamber was simply just, you know, pushed aside. And it's very interesting to use the same terminology that my colleague is using, and if that is the case, this is little again just a toy telephone where it's simply just a talk shop and nothing is binding, whatever length of conversation has taken place. That's the one question, Madam Chair. The other question I'd like to clarify on is, it is often stated that the delegations that partners send to NEDLAC, and here in particular reference is made to government as well as business, they did send the most, not the most, but junior delegations They do not have the authority or the mandate to make binding commitments in the chamber. So the question is that to what extent can delegations be forced, for lack of a better word, to make sure that they do send people there that can commit. And lastly, Madam Chair, the director stated clearly that the social dialogue is under pressure. The role and relevance of NEDLAC is constantly being questioned. It is characterized by an atmosphere of adversarialism, trust, and there exists a serious consensus deficit within the structure. Having highlighted that and knowing that that is part of where they are now, are any processes being put into place as to how we could sort of ease that sort of adversarialism and whatever consensus and trust building mechanisms have been sort of considered to make it less pressurized the engagement amongst parties. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Today I have two questions. The first one is on the issue of finances. We are only given a report on summary of expenditure. That is not the picture we want. We want a full picture. What is the audit outcome? That is where it's going to be reflected, whether we are moving forward or not. The second issue is you have a slide that has about six areas that are identified as for areas for strategic focus, but there are no time frames for those. Then can you attach time frames to those so that we can be able to monitor whether you have managed to meet all those, though it's just a shopping list which is just bullet issues, but you need to know when do you think you are going to do this, because it's for 2014-15 anyway. Thank you.
Over to you, another point.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm quite private on the other issue, but the director is raising the issue on the way mentioned the Executive Council. He is mentioning what the original intention was. But I'm referring to the unspoken word in this regard. And I want to know what is happening in practice currently. If the Executive Council is meeting the intention upon establishment currently. The next one is with regards to the staff establishment currently. If we can have a breakdown on the establishment in terms of the gender, disability, and also race. And if they are making use of consultants. Thank you, Josephine.
Thanks, Chairperson. Seeing as the director of the NEDLAC raised the question of relevance and the role of NEDLAC in his presentation, I want to go straight there and ask whether he thinks the mandate of NEDLAC shouldn't change. My view is that NEDLAC represents the ganging up of big business, big labor, and big government, and does not consider those who are outside of that limit. So for example, it looks like the insiders are everybody that's big, and the outsiders are everybody who's not big, the small players. So SMEs, micro-enterprises, unemployed people really seem to be locked out of the equation at NEDLAC. And the attempt by NEDLAC to create create an additional group within their structure for, I don't know what you call them these days,
community
entities, obviously to work. When you speak to those community entities at their level, what they tell you is by the time they get to deal with either legislation or regulations or whatever else, the big boys have already locked up the key issues, that they're an also-ran, that they're an afterthought, that they're not considered. Secondly, one has to question whether those groupings represent the unemployed and small enterprises and micro-enterprises adequately. I don't think they do. I think, quite frankly, big business, big government, and big labor shakes hands, fights, and sends us an agreement, and then writes down a list of the things that they don't agree on for Parliament to sort out. I think that that social compact doesn't include everybody, and that is partly what's leading to the breakdown currently. Should we not be changing the mandate of NEDLAC so that we can find a greater voice for the unemployed and a greater voice for small and micro enterprises so that big business and big labor and big government don't lock them out and develop laws and regulations that suit the big boys? Because it seems to me like the stuff that we see does suit the big players. And then we have a meltdown when enough of the small players get angry. And we've seen real trouble in the last while. For 20 years, we had some problems. Last year, we seem to have got into a different environment altogether. My commentator said to me the other day that it's like labor negotiations has gone back to the 80s. And I'm wondering if we're not in danger of going back to that kind of environment, if we don't bring the outsiders into the discussion. I won't repeat the questions asked by other people because I agree with some of those that you've already heard, and thank you very much, Jefferson.
Thanks, Chair. I'm just not quite sure about, I'm worried about the apologies. Justice that day. Because according to how they were presented, there are three. And those three apologies, it looks like they are key people. They are key people in terms of how the structure runs. As to whether NEDLAC takes this process serious to have three apologies and three attendants, this could just be difficult. I'm sure the director will help us there. One would have loved to have these three documents which the director is saying they are there as part of the package, just to have a sense of what those documents are saying, unless they are saying what is presented here. But I'm sure in the detailed form, they would help us to engage much better. I'm sure those documents would also give light in terms of the convened national summit or summit, and when was the last convened, what were the issues, because maybe the summit, I haven't seen the report yet, but it was going to be useful if it is there. Maybe the national summit would have raised or flex some of the issues in terms of the challenges which are there. That includes the entire issues, including the social dialogue is under pressure. What have they said? But to see, for a start, there are three documents. I don't know the size of those documents, but I imagine they are quite sizable. And two, the national summit itself, to share light that more members, when they were alone together in the summit, as part of the mandate, this is what they have discussed. And in moving forward, they think about the following, unless the matter here. Well, I heard it again that there is a need for another forum for social dialogue. See, that is serious. That is serious. It's serious. And if it's raised by nature itself, say, no, let's have an alternative. Unless I didn't pick it properly, but you clarify it. Let's have an alternative. It means you must then go strong, because you can't have two networks. But I think you'll be able just to keep life. The rest, I think, are the members of the
government. Thank you, Honorable Minister Kwana. Over to you, Honorable Matisha.
Thanks. Mine will be very short, because they've covered which one wanted to move right. My short question to the director. Do you think you're still relevant? I'm raising that point because if you, for example, check page 21, the points that you've written there indicate that which you've got to do, that which you are doing, etc. Now, if you take those and basically just support them with that which CCMA is doing and other structures are doing, for example, what business is doing, what government is doing, what labor is doing, you know, from industry to industry, those particular points, you actually are treating yourself. Therefore, that says that the duplication of different assets. Hence, I'm saying, do you think that you're still relevant? Or should we say, for example, we take and make with you other structures and institutions, such as CCMA? They fall under you, they become one of your desks, which will be there to coordinate and deal with this kind of problem that are there, that permeate the labor, milieu, the problems that are there between employers and employees, etc., etc. I'm saying that basically because I'm looking at that which you have written there. But further, saying this because one is going back to the original goals for which NetLab was established. I therefore say, don't you think that you yourself then should either go or we should take other structures such as CCNA and so on, put them under you? Why? Because after all, industry, tech industry, you have negotiation structures. Therefore, CCMA, for example, does not have anything to do. So if they're under yourselves, then they become an arm that will be able to deal with the coordination of you know, whatever problems that may be there under the labor employer kind of problems. Are you still relevant? I think further intriguing that looking at other Chapter 9 institutions which are doing some of the work that the network is doing. The development of policies, are there one area to the other? Business has come together and actually working beyond that which NetLeg is doing. Government evolves policies outside of NetLeg, of course. Other institutions, like I said, are there to make sure that there's labor peace, there's business peace, etc. Are we still relevant? Just throwing that chapter.
There is no question from NMERC that is wrong, because the questions that you're asking are motivated by a number of issues. NetLeg is an act of Parliament, and we are members of Parliament. We, through an act, brought NetLeg into existence. I just want to leave it at that stage, whether the question that we are asking, is it a question that we should be asking amongst ourselves in the committee, or do you think that they should continue to answer it?
Look, I'm not irrelevant, I must emphasize. Yes, I know that the NetLeg has come, you know, basically because here as the government we are stressed that we must have all these institutions. I understand that perfectly well. But then there are developments, and yes, before we sit now as a parliament, as a government, etc., we must have gone into these nitty-gritties, must have understood that which they are raising. They are saying, for example, that faced with this kind of problems, they are saying they have a problem themselves insofar as the work that they are doing, the questions of relevancy is so often, and that's why I'm quoting from this paper. On page 21, they are saying that there are this kind of challenges, and I'm making a follow-up on the issues that they've put there. Yes, we are going to discuss and understand, but then I am saying to them, based on what you have written, based on the discussions you have had, based on the practices and everything that you have been doing over a period of 20 years, you will think this is relevant. The acts, of course, are there. Many things are there. And very many. Besides that, like many other things, many other acts, many other institutions have been removed because of things such as the ones that we see that NetLeg is putting into us here. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you, Honorable Matisha. I will not engage further. I will leave this over to NetLeg to answer for themselves.
I must appreciate the work that he has done in the last 2 years, looking at the improvement of some areas, in particular your government. But I have one question that I need clarity on, whether you are winning the battle against non-coherence amongst the social, government. I don't want to be your social steward.
Thank you, Honorable Montage. I will give it over to the director and his official to answer the question. I must say before you respond to the question that the concern that has been raised by Honorable Juan, I've noted it, and I will allow you to give a further explanation that it is required. However, I do know that it is not going to happen again. It will not. I promise you. In fact, when we invite departments, we are fully aware of not bringing everybody. And we have to take into account the cost. But there are certain people who have to be here who must come and account to Parliament. And when that day or day comes, nobody can give us any excuse. You know, for the DG and the department, including yourself, the notice was actually a 24-hour notice. And we did the courtesy to explain why he is here and make it a point that everybody is here. Because we also have to meet the deadlines of Parliament. He has to put everything aside and he has been sitting here for the last 2 days. And I'm sure he has very important things to do. But as the head of that department, he knows his constitutional duty to be here. So I'm not really worried because I know it is very, very.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think that point is well noted. I certainly will take that message back to the overall conveners, and I thank you for appreciating that. But I think one of the reasons has been the notice period. I think if we had much more notice, I think we would have some of the other overall conveners would have been able to make it. But I certainly will take that message back to them. I would also perhaps appreciate, and maybe it's not a conversation we need to have today, but I think we need to perhaps engage with the department as well as with the committee around the perhaps the peculiar or unique nature of the entity and how it functions. I think there are some issues around the way it is governed that is quite pertinent. So for example, my role as the executive officer and as the accounting officer, which is why I certainly will drop everything to ensure that I need to be here to account, because that is my mandate and that's what I've been dedicated to do. One of the challenges is that we don't have a governing body very similar to the one like the CCMA, and so we don't have a chair that is there for a specific period. It's done on a rotational basis, and so really we're talking to the overall conveners, and a lot of times these are, except for government, these are people who have full time jobs in other parts that they don't get paid for. So it is an issue that I think that we confront all the time.
and I would appreciate an opportunity to engage later on around the governance issues. But I would certainly take that message back to the overall conveners. And just on that note, on the broad point, I think just to accept that the protocol document and the Red Light Act and the Constitution, these are fairly large documents. And I will certainly, you know, make sure that we.
I wanted to say something. You know, I fully understand and accept your submission of people who are doing with other responsibilities somewhere. However, when they took this responsibility, they knew that now and again, they will be called to Parliament 24 hours, not this much. The times when people are called to be in Parliament, you know, following the few hours. So really, I think it was enough for you to say, let's accept it better, because the more you will try to justify it, the more you are incriminating yourself. So, thank you.
Thank you very much. Just going to, I accept that. I mean, I think I will take back the message. Just in terms of the protocol document and the Ned Lack Act and Constitution, I will certainly make those documents available. They are fairly thick documents. We're talking about the Ned Lack Act. The Constitution is almost, I think, 80 pages long, so they're quite beautiful documents, and so I will endeavour to make those available. Then, Chair, also just in terms of the employment equities stuff, I mean, all of this is in the annual report. I don't think we've got copies of them with me, but again, and the current performance report and annual report and financials are about to be finalize and sign off, and I gather we will have another opportunity later in the year to report back to the committee on the audited reports, both in the performance side as well. But in the meantime, I would commit to send the details in terms of the staffing breakdown, the gender breakdown, disabled. We've got all of that information, and I look forward to those as soon as I get back. So I think then. To deal then with a related question to Honourable Member Noliwe, in terms of the specific audit outcomes, again, once the final report is done, I think we will have an opportunity to come back. If you do want the specific findings of the previous year, I think what we should just do is make available the annual report of those. They're all specified there. And then in terms of the APP, I haven't put it in this particular presentation, but again, I will send through the specific APP document, which has all of the very specific targets that we put on. But I will talk to some of the high-level ones that I have raised and the targets that we have put. But for most of them, we have got the specific targets. And for most of the legislation that we deal with, basically that is governed by the protocol document. So it's really saying that we are driven by a certain turnaround time and not necessarily a specific date by which in the year. So it depends on when that process commences. Once it starts, you then have 6 months to complete that particular process. But we will send through the details on the APP. Chair, I suppose then the big questions that have been raised around the role and relevance of NEDLAC. And I suppose to start with and saying, you know, from where I'm sitting as the Secretariat, and I'm raising certain questions, I'm suggesting here that the relevance of NEDLAC is being questioned in a kind of public way. And not necessarily that I'm questioning the relevance of NEDLAC. In my mind, I think NEDLAC is more relevant than ever in our history. And in my mind, if we don't pay serious attention to strengthening our efforts to build social dialogue, as a society, we are going to be in deep, deep trouble. And that's the message that I'm going to put on. So I think, in terms of relevance, it is more critical than ever before in our history. There's also another thing that is peculiar about this particular entity, because, and I said it, I think it's important that we look at when this entity was established, and it was the first act of Parliament in 1994, which signaled the shift from apartheid to democracy in a whole range of areas, and particularly in terms of our labour market issue. And I think it's significant that the first act that was passed through this body was the Labour Relations Act. And it took us also about almost a year and a half. And it was a very difficult, complex, protracted, painful series of negotiations. But it was negotiated line by line by the social partners, and we had 100% convergence. So, and these were representatives who spoke to everyone. They didn't just speak for big business or for big labor. They spoke for workers in general and entrenching rights for workers in general. Business talked about building a regime of cooperation, of empowerment, of transformation at the workplace across. We talked about rights for workers, whether it was in the formal sector or the informal sector. That was the contract we made with the First Labor Relations Act. And we all committed ourselves to that particular thing. So it wasn't forced onto anyone. It was a process of intense negotiation. It is also interesting that was also the first time. So at the time when it was born, the relevance of NEDLAC was questioned. When the LRA was introduced, and I don't know how many of us were around at the time to remember, and this comes back to the question of the role of Parliament, madam. Okay. Where you had one of the most successful endeavors in social dialogue, following one of the most successful political transitions. Many people call it the military. They're one of the most successful pieces of law that's negotiated with social partners. And it was, Parliament was very, 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 very unhappy with that. And Parliament was unhappy because in a sense it was like social partners were saying, please Parliament, don't tamper with this. So there's almost the kind of opposite to the kind of scenario that you have now where the social partners agree and we've got to say that, you know, Parliament simply ignores what we want. Parliament was quite miffed at the time that they had to accept this particular package. So yes, I think we have to accept that there's an evolutionary pattern, that there's a rise and fall in, if you want, in the kind of relevance or the perceived relevance of an entity. That's the first point I would make, Honourable Matisha. The second point that I would make is that this is highly, highly contested space politically. And this is what makes NEDLAC such a, I suppose, such an interesting and sometimes such a difficult space. Because it is a space that acts as a lightning rod. It brings together all of the issues and contestations between not the social partners and between the political actors. For particular pieces of policy and legislation. It brings it together. And that's one of the roles of an institution like this, that it does act as a bringing together, as a kind of, you want, shock absorber. That's the purpose. The danger of that is that it gets used, if you want, as a political football. It's a bit of a punching bag. And I think that's in the nature of what it is. So it is going to be looked at through a political prism. It is going to be perceived in a particular way. And I suppose when you ask the question around relevance, if you ask me the question of relevance, there's no doubt in my mind that it is more relevant than ever. If you ask many, many business leaders, and even if you ask many small business owners, I think you will find that the thinking people recognize that what is important in an institution like this. So that's just a general question of relevance. I think the question that Honourable Hollis, you are raising is a very important question. I don't personally have any specific
opinions at this stage about what needs to be done. I think there's some people say that there's perhaps an issue around design from the very beginning. Right? And I think the debate, and this is not just a debate in South Africa, this is a debate about tripartism worldwide. If you go to the ILO, this debate comes up. Many people see the South African model as actually a benchmark. And they may call it tripartite plus. Now there's a very strong school of thought that in fact says that we want to keep it as a tripartite plus. You want to keep it so you don't want to kind of bring in all kinds of voices. You know, so it's about how do you find the space to bring in all kinds of voices. But at the end of the day, if you want to negotiate, if you want your way out of a crisis, or your way out of the negotiation, then you need to have very strongly organized interest groups that are able to pact and are able to stick and make compromises on behalf of constituencies and are able to see this through. And so I suppose that's perhaps the dilemma. So I would say that yes, and maybe we look at how do we use the existing structures, and maybe it's a question of emphasis in the mandate, and how do we enforce other parts of the mandate. So I think the mandate is, and if you look at the summit, the mandate is that efforts must be made to bring on board other voices. And that should be an ongoing thing. But if you want, at the negotiating table, at the apex level, I think we would have to think about how we do that. And then I would also say that I think we within NEDLAC, we're conflating, it's not just about labor market and about labor market policy. It is also about other areas of economic policy. And it is about creating the kind of enabling conversations and enabling frameworks for the labor market, but not the implementation. And I suppose this goes back to the question that Honorable Madisha had raised around the CCMA and others. I think it is about these institutions linking up in a much better way and coordinating in a much better way. The issue around sort of insiders, outsiders, particularly within the labor market, I think is an issue that we need to take on board. I don't think that requires a fundamental shift in the industrial relations systems per se. And I also think that we tend to generalize this thing. I think it's a sort of sector by sector basis. So I do think that this is a complicated debate. I mean, I think we tend to overcomplicate because a lot of times it's ideological. And so I would support the idea that what one needs is a broader conversation to kind of bring these other different viewpoints in and say, let's actually look at this question. And let's do the necessary kind of research and delve into it, because perhaps we can come to a shared understanding. But if we look at the sort of nature of the engagement, if we just look at the media, a lot of the stuff is rhetorical, a lot of the stuff is ideological, it's positional, almost mirrors what happens within the collective bargaining system, if you want, that we talked about earlier. We tend to be in a positional mode, and I'm saying that for all of the constituencies, the leadership challenge is to say, can you break out of that? And you can't legislate for that. You can't regulate for that. It's a leadership question. So, Chair, then I think to specifically come then to the point that Honourable the Member Bahrain has made. Again, I think with the LRA, it's important that we don't perhaps generalize on this question. I think that there was a view that, you know, the social partners had consensus on a particular thing, brought it to Parliament, and Parliament kicked it out. I think by and large, it was misinformation in my opinion, and I think we should look at the specifics. And in my understanding, the areas, particularly around temporary employment, was contested. Some were worked out. And the issue around banning or not banning, or whether we get sort of a 12-month, we had a couple of proposals on the table. There was originally a sort of 24-month period, there was then a sort of 12-month potential concession. Government, I think, came up with a 6-month proposal. And those are the positions. So at the end of the day, what was registered was that there's no consensus on this issue, But these are the positions of the different stakeholders, and that is what was recorded. The issue with Atypical was that in the portfolio committee, I think they then decided to do something completely different from any of those positions, which is obviously Parliament's right. Parliament can sovereign, Parliament can change the law if it wants. But it is also saying, you know, and we have a responsibility as legislators to take into account what is happening in the society, the voices of society, and sometimes we take decisions at our peril. And so we have to pay attention to these things. And that is one example. I think another example which is relevant in the current context is around the issue of violence and strikes. This issue is not a new issue. This issue has in fact been raised, and I think in fairness to the department, was raised by the department, I think it's part of the original set of reform proposals that was presented. Not that it is gone well with all sort of marijuana and durance and all of that, but saying, you know, we are witnessing a tendency towards increased unprotected strike action. There's also an issue around violence. So the issue is without encroaching on the rights, the organizational rights of trade unions, without encroaching on the rights of workers, is there a way in which we can build in greater accountability? Now, some of the proposals was around a strike ballot. That was a proposal that was put. There was also, I think, a proposal on recourse to the labor court. So with the public interest type issue, where clearly, you know, lives are being lost or properties being damaged to such an extent, or economy-wide damage, that there would be some recourse to the court. And that was the proposal. Now, these aren't perfect, I think, solutions, but the department was beginning to raise them. Now, there was no agreement between the constituencies on that particular set of provisions, and the various positions were captured. The department, in a way, stuck to its guns in its proposed legislation, but it was Parliament at the time, and, you know, while you are being frank, I think it was political expediency before the elections, and Parliament decided to drop those provisions, or portfolio committee, I think, dropped those provisions. So I'm saying it's the cut and thrust of these kinds of processes, but really, you know, Parliament is sovereign, but we have a building mechanism that allows us to filter the views of the social partners. Yes, many times those are the most organized interests, they're the stronger interests, and that is something we need to recognize, not shy away from. And I think we need to find ways in which we bring on board the other voices as well. But at the end of the day, it's about getting compromises and agreements that can stick. I think that's the current problem that we have. And if we look maybe at the marijuana thing, is that in fact a lot of the precursors to that particular tragedy was that there were efforts to bypass the existing system, actually. And the internal dynamics within the NUM. So what it was wasn't strong unions, it was actually a weakening of the unions and a fragmentation. And what I'm suggesting when I say is that one of our challenges as a society is that within these constituencies that they're actually getting weaker because they're getting fragmented. And that's, for me, a serious issue and issue for leadership. Now, how we accommodate these various voices, I think, is an important point of acknowledgement. And we need to, I think, think together about how we go forward on that. Honourable for Schalkwijk on the Executive Council and the role of the Executive Council. I think this speaks to the kind of generalization issue. And I think again that's a sort of a mixed picture, because at some level I think what has been happening is that at the chamber level you're dealing with a hell of a lot more legislation and quite complex legislation. And what you're finding is that, by and large, it's the people with the kind of technical knowledge and the negotiators who come. Because if you send the kind of leaders who sort of at the strategic level to engage on the specifics of some of these things, you know, so you're getting the negotiators around the table. And in my view, that's not necessarily a juniorization. I think one of the issues, though, is about the mandate process. So how do the principals in the constituencies empower and guide and mandate? And in a case like, in fact, not just Labour, I was going to say in a case like Labour, but both Labour and business, it's a question of empowering and giving the mandate from above. So the principals give a mandate, but it's also about getting the mandate from below. And so sometimes that's what takes time, because these guys have to go back within business. I mean, you find different viewpoints. The finance sector differs by and large from what the manufacturing sector wants and says. The mining sector believes, but that it's an arm game, it wants its own things. But at the end of the day, you know, how do you then speak on behalf of sort of business, whether it's small, whether it's black, whether it's, you know, so that is one of the challenges of social dialogue at an apex level. It's a challenge all over the world. Some models do it better than others, and I think, again, we need to open up that conversation, but make it a rational conversation. Make it not such a polarized conversation, not such a politicized conversation. So I think then coming to the role of ESCO, Madame, yes, I think over the years, so that is what's been happening. It kind of slipped. So in the first sort of 3-4 years of Medlac's existence, we had a certain generation of ministers who were involved. But remember, you almost started with a blank sheet in terms of legislation. So there was a lot of interest in laying that kind of foundation. And I think 10 years, 15 years later, the legislative challenge becomes a different one. It's more kind of tweaking of policy, tweaking of sort of those kind of reforms. And so there's a lot of litigation that happens. And I think that's one thing that's been going on. Within the constituency itself, I think there's also an issue around succession. So again, you found a particular generation of leaders within labor, within business, who move on without a new generation actually having been groomed and coming in. So that's part of that leadership challenge. There is a juniorization. I don't think it's necessarily the right term. So I think it's a bit more complex than that. Can we do something about it? By all means, I think we can. And this is why I think we're raising it as a leadership challenge. And let's say, let's not sort of make excuses for this. So if we're going to look at the Executive Council, I think in the past what we've had was we would invite particular ministers to do briefings on particular things and then have a particular form of engagement. I think what we need to do now is to have more of a, if you want, quarterly strategic conversation on the big questions. But I think part of the difficulty is that we don't have the overarching sort of consensus. I mean, if we had, for example, consensus around the reconstruction and development program like we had in 1994, and that consensus at the national level dissipated. Okay. We now try to craft a new consensus around the national development plan. But if we had such a national vision, that at the very least all social partners agreed with, that, you know, this is not about my constituency, this is about the nation, it's about society, South Africa Incorporated. And we all at least agreed to that as a broad plan, then the other conversations become a lot easier. And so I think so I am saying that I think, you know, that's also an issue, and it's not an issue that you're going to resolve in Myanmar. But I think we want to raise that particular issue. It's an issue I would suspect impacts on Parliament as well. But how do we begin to craft some consensus around the national vision? That, I think, is one of the specific challenges for an institution like Myanmar. So, for example, we know now that there's some concerns from some constituencies around some parts of the National Development Plan. Can we, in our programs as well, begin to unpack that and hold in a lot more? So if we then say, okay, the problem is around this part of labor market policy, which part of labor market policy exactly is that? And is this based on perception? Is this based, you know, let's look at the research, let's get different evidence based on the table, and then start having a different kind of conversation, which is why, from our APP perspective, we're talking about let's till the soil, the social dialogue. We're saying, you know, we're not going to start picking the roots of social dialogue just yet. What we actually need to do is to go back and till the soil, then we've got to plant the seed, then we've got to grow the seed, then we can start picking the fruit. We want to now sort of pick fruits on a tree that has kind of suffered because of different climates and soil conditions and stuff, and expecting something that we can't have right now. So it's, you know, so it's about all the constituents stepping back and say, what is it that you want to do? And see, so when you talk about their land, there's a set of areas, Honorable Madisha, that can give a view around it's relevant. But their land is also you and me. It's the constituencies themselves. Their land is business, it is labor, it is parts of the community as well. So I think from the EXCO point of view, we need to perhaps, and one of the discussions has been that maybe what we need to look at is, and this is why I think we welcome this initiative from the President of the State Federation Base, and to say under the auspices of the Deputy President, can we maybe lead a process of a different kind of conversation? So you're injecting a new momentum and there's political leadership coming. And so when we convene our executive councils, perhaps, you know, but there's a very strong role by the Deputy President as mandated in the SONA address. So I think that you know, it's not about fundamentally changing the mandate necessarily or even the structures, but saying we can't just ignore those other opinions and voices. We actually need to engage in them in a more constructive way. I'm not sure if I've missed any other of the specific questions that Honorable America. I think I have tried to respond to some of the questions specifically around the rules of engagement, perhaps maybe just to come back to that. On the protocol issue, clearly this is not binding in the legal sense, you know, so you can't compel and then have other kind of legal consequences. So it is based on a kind of moral and you know, and that's basically social dialogue. You say you want to build a trust and make these kind of agreements, and by and large, the social partners have to that. You know, it's very unlikely that, and this is why if you have a disciplined voice, an organized voice, that makes a commitment that then goes to Parliament and undoubts that particular commitment, you know, all that you get to do is this trust. So it doesn't happen very often. Again, the early examples that have been used around the LRA, I think is based on a misunderstanding. It's just not areas of agreement that have been undone by Parliament. And Parliament has accepted this by and large. Where there are areas of convergence, by and large, Parliament doesn't interfere with those. There have been one or two sort of instances. But again, this is contested space, which is why I say we need to develop a deeper understanding and respect for the protocols amongst all of the constituencies. And we have also raised with the Deputy President's Office and the Leader of Government Business that we really develop a kind of agree with Parliament and with portfolio committees, a sort of parliamentary protocol, so that we can develop a deeper understanding of what's been happening within those negotiations, you know, so we come in at it with a richer understanding and appreciation of the dynamics. I think all in all what this does is make for better legislation, there's greater ownership and there's more accountability. And the lesson is that where we kind of try and take the sort of shortcut routes, we usually end up with the problem afterwards. Madam Chair, I'm going to ask some assistance. Are there any of the specific questions that I have missed out, and I would ask the assistance just to come back to those.
Okay, Derek, you can keep this question among your officers. Hello.
Madam Chair, just on, I think, was Honourable Mkhwana's question around the summit and the report. Yes, there is a report on the summit, and it will be in the annual report. So in every annual report, there's a detail of what was at the previous summit, which was in September last year, where basically our theme for that summit was filling the soil for social dialogue, and it was really throwing out the challenge to social partners that these are some of the complexities and difficulties. And we did come out of that summit with a sort of overriding appreciation that we need to have greater commitment from leadership in all of the constituencies. But it is kind of saying, can we lay the foundations. This year, I think with the State of the Nation Fest and this initiative, we're working closely with the Deputy President on, I think gives momentum to that. And I think that's going to frame this particular summit. But I think the point that has been made about bringing in other voices and how do we become a lot more creative around the summit is very important. Now this comes back to the question of resources as well. I mean, a big event like that takes a lot of your resources. And if you want to do these kind of things, feel this kind of conversation, comes back to saying, look, you know, we're talking about research, we're talking about symposia, we're talking about linking up internationally, then we need to begin to resource these things adequately. Thank you.
Thank you, Director. I have a question, thank you. Senator Pula, Natasha?
As far as I'm concerned, the Director has responded to all the questions. I can say repeatedly, and I just want to assure him that it is not in the interest of this Parliament to disband it, because it is the only platform where those social partners engage the legislation that are, you know, under discussion in this Parliament. So don't panic. Just ending there. We are here to understand what you're doing, not to destroy what has been done by our predecessors. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam.
Thank you. It's clear that there are no further questions from the minister. Thank you so much. We just hope that in the future you will give us what we need from you in terms of delegation. Thank you so much.
I will commit to that, Madam. Thank you so much, and thank you to the committee members.
Thank you. 5 minutes break. What is the sacred activities preparing themselves for presentation? Just 5 minutes.